This is Autoline After Hours with John McElroy and Gary Vasilash, episode 428 for July 20th, 2018. Genovation GXE, the world's fastest electric Corvette. Watch Autoline After Hours live at autoline.tv every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 p.m. Pacific. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or YouTube.
Autoline After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion, and by Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems.
All right, everybody, welcome to Autoline After Hours, especially welcome to my co-host, Gary Vasilash.
John, how are you?
I'm doing really well.
All right, I don't want to make a habit out of this, but last week we noted the Rolling Stones' first concert happened on the day
of that show.
So,
right.
So you got to agree, one of the all-time best cars on television was the Trans Am that was driven by Jim Rockford of the Rockford Files.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, everybody would agree with that, right?
Yeah.
So in 2014, James Garner died on this day. So just a little tribute. So next week, I promise not to have a date.
Yeah, well, hold on, because you never know. You're going to find out some spectacular event in history occurred.
I know.
It seems to coincide with the show.
It does.
Hey, we got to let everybody know, Greg Migliar, the editor-in-chief, is that the right title?
That's me.
Of Autoblog.
That's us. It's good to be here.
Yeah, it's
thanks
great
for
to have
me.
You back on the show. And we've got to let everybody know, our special guest for the first half of today's show is Andrew Saul, CEO of a company called Genovation. And Andrew, great to have you here.
Thank you for having me, John.
Great well, I, actually, I don't know how great it is to have you here, but it's awesome to have your car.
Thank you.
So give us a quick thumbnail sketch just to get this conversation going. What the hell is this thing?
So it's a Corvette, a Grand Sport, C7 based, that we've converted to 100% electric. And it's got a couple world records. It's got a Guinness World Record in the standing mile of 190. And then a EMRA certified top speed world record of 209. That was based on the C6 Z06. This new car is going to break 220, and we're hoping to do that this fall. And what really makes it fun is that it's a stick shift. So this is a 7-speed manual. It's got
to be the only manual transmission electric in the world.
At this power level, it definitely is. So it's a lot of fun to drive, and that was really our objective, was to make a really fun, high-tech car that people would just love to own and love to drive. And I think the team has achieved that with it.
So where's your company based?
We're in Rockville, Maryland, so about half an hour north of D.C.
Mm-hmm.
The cars are built here in Michigan with the Prefix Corporation.
And we should add a little background for those who have never heard of Prefix. They did much of the work on the last generation Ford GT.
That's right.
They painted all the Dodge Vipers.
Yep.
They're currently painting all the current generation Ford GTs as well.
That's right. And they fabricate the gas tanks for the current GT as well. Mm. So, yeah. Amazing company. I mean, their history is really fascinating. But they've got one of the world's top interior trim shops, and they helped us design that interior that's just striking.
I got to tell you, I saw this car, I saw you a couple of months ago or something like that.
Yeah.
And the only reason I thought, oh, yeah, this car should come on the show is it is beautifully turned out.
Thank you.
I mean, this is OEM level quality of execution.
It really is. I mean, we wanted to push new boundaries with this car. And we interviewed a number of different contract manufacturers, and Prefix really convinced us that they could bring it, and they sure did.
So how does it work? I mean, did they buy a Corvette from
the local
Chevy dealer?
And that's what we've done with the prototypes. We're working on our third prototype now. It'll be our first automatic, so an 8-speed automatic with a paddle shift transmission, and we buy them in Rockville and bring them up here for the conversion. Yeah.
Very cool, very cool. What's your production run kind of looking at? Do you have a volume? Will you build as many as people want?
Just 75.
Okay.
And each one will have a unique paint color. So once you pick that paint color, Prefix has a very large palette of different colors you can choose from. But once you pick your color, you get to name it and nobody else can have it. Customers can come in and meet with a design team and design their own interior. And it's got a custom Harman 9-speaker stereo that's world-class. Harman said they think it's one of the best stereos they've ever done. And it's got a custom large touchscreen with different drive modes. You can control the suspension. It's got a programmable active suspension. The next car will also have an active wing that's also programmable, and so we're going to tune it for different tracks. You want Laguna Seca mode one day, you got it.
Very cool. Very cool.
Yeah.
That really is cool. Give us a little bit of the specs on the whole electric part of it. You know, what kind of motors, a battery pack, that sort of thing.
Sure. The motors are AC induction, permanent magnet. There are two of them, and they pancake together in the front. And then there's an adapter plate, and it bolts right up to the stock GM bell housing. And the rest of the driveline is stuck.
But it's still a rear drive car.
Rear drive, yeah, absolutely. But the neat thing with electrics is, you know, you get that instant torque, but you also have the capability for really good traction control because it just reacts so much faster than a gas engine could.
Yeah, right.
It's literally about 1,000 times quicker. So even in the rain, there's no wheel hop, there's no wheel spin. It just hooks up and launches. Unless you turn off the traction control, and then you can drift
and
it.
Hang on for dear life. Right?
Yeah, I compared to some other electric cars, you can't drift them, but this car you really can.
Yeah.
What kind of batteries do you use?
They're 18650s, and they're a hybrid NCA NCM chemistry. Very state of the art. We do a very thorough job testing them, and the packs are designed and built here in Michigan. So, mm-hmm. Yeah.
How about a 0 to 60 time? I bet it's pretty quick.
We're thinking under 2.5 seconds. We haven't had it to the drag.
It's pretty quick.
Yeah.
Okay. Quarter mile time, anything like that?
I haven't done that either, but okay. Yeah, it's going to be
fast. But you've done some other testing. You quoted some high-speed stuff.
Yeah, we did that down at the Kennedy Space Center on the Space Shuttle runway. We
had one does, right?
Yeah, of course. We had a great driver, Johnny Bomer, who runs the facility, did our driving. And, boy, he took it out just to, you know, shake the car out and see what it felt like. And he had the windows down when he left and came back with a big grin. He'd hit 160 just checking the car out and said, yeah, you got something here.
In fact, Kit Gerhardt, one of our friends here, wrote in to say, I saw a Genovation Corvette a couple of years ago when they were testing it for top speed at the Kennedy Space Center.
Great.
Shuttle landing strip.
Yeah.
He said the car I saw was a C5 or 6.
C6.
But the ones that you guys plan to sell will be C7s. He's got a question, though. Is there a market for a $750,000 Corvette with less than half the range of a regular vet?
Well, here's the thing. Most people who buy a supercar, they don't drive it, you know, more than 50 miles in a day, I don't think. And based on the feedback that we're getting from prospects, car collectors from around the country, I think there is a market for 75. And it doesn't appeal to all car collectors, but there's definitely a base out there that wants the latest technology. They want a car that's set world records and that's really blazing a new trail. Mm-hmm. And I think it's appealing to those people. And there's certainly enough Corvette collectors out there that this really appeals to.
So. Right. So if somebody hammers it, did they get a 50-mile range?
So we did two 200-mile-an-hour passes, and we still had 100 miles of range left.
Really?
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And this was, on a hot summer day down in Florida. You could open the hood and touch anything under the hood. Nothing was hot. It was just warm. And that's because the motors are up to 97% efficient, so there's very little waste heat.
Unbelievable.
Yeah,
that's impressive.
It's incredible.
How big is the battery pack in it?
So it's a 61-kilowatt-hour battery pack.
Okay.
There are 5,700, roughly, batteries, individual 18650 cells.
Can you say who makes the battery pack for you?
We're battery agnostic, so we're constantly testing new chemistries. We tend to stick with the top three, mm-hmm. Just for quality control.
And that would be what, LG?
Samsung and Panasonic.
Panasonic,
yeah.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Okay.
What's the regenerative experience like? Like, I'm picturing, like, some cars, the braking is just so demonstrative. What's that like? And I imagine that would be pretty good on a track, too.
Oh, yeah. And we'll be able to dial that in for different tracks as well. So if you want more regen, it'll simulate more of a high compression gas engine or less if you're not used to it or comfortable with it. So you'll have different regen modes. Mm. But you can recover quite a bit of energy doing that and have some fun with it. So,
pretty cool.
Yeah, definitely.
So, Andrew, what's your background? How did you get to be doing this?
I'm a history major. I don't really know how this all happened.
That makes perfect sense to me.
Right. Yeah.
History and econ. And I started out my career in banking and a little bit of real estate. And it just sort of, I got the itch to do something innovative and actually started out doing research on combustion engine technology. And that kind of morphed into electric vehicles. So it's been a fun journey.
What was the aha moment that went, aha, an electric Corvette?
It was really, going to different trade shows and talking with different engineers and realizing that there are, these new inverters that are really amazing. Our inverters are used by some of the Formula One teams. And then the same thing with the electric motors. There were these great new motors, and it was really a matter of building a battery pack that could supply the inverters and the motors with the necessary juice. And then the software, which is absolutely critical. Having a team that can really take care of that on a high level was very important. So we've got that.
So
why a sports car rather than, say, a muscle car? Why didn't you do a Challenger or a Mustang or something?
Well, we knew that we were onto something, that would really shine on a runway and mostly on a racetrack. I mean, we wanted to build a car that would go fast around the Nürburgring. We wanted to do one lap of the Nürburgring and Laguna Seca and try to set a record. And, it just happened during the course of testing on the runway, it happened to break those records. We weren't expecting it to go that fast. And GM, we met with some of the guys at GM, and they said, well, it was our record that you broke at 177. And so we were pretty upset with you, but then we realized you used a Corvette, so they forgave us.
Yeah, what does a Corvette think about what you're doing here?
They loved it. They were very encouraging. They were very impressed. And they had nothing but good things to say about what we've done.
Cool.
Yeah, it was really neat.
I'm curious, do you have any, like, celebrity interests or something? Like, when I picture this car, I can see, like, Leonardo DiCaprio or somebody who's, he owned, like, a couple of Fiskars, I think, or something.
Yeah.
Anybody like that you can let us, hint at? I don't know.
So, yeah, we had it at Amelia Island, and Michael Strahan heard about the car, and he made a trip down to cool. check the car out. He sat in it, and his buddy said, you're not going to fit in that Corvette. And he said, oh, yeah, I will. And he hopped right in, fit no problem. Emerson Fittipaldi also checked it out and had a seat, and he wants to help us do some tuning.
He's doing his own car, too, so that's really cool.
Yeah. So he's a big fan of high-performance electrics. And we've talked with some other, serious car collectors, and there seems to be genuine interest. So
cool.
You funding it, or you've got funders?
Mostly funding it myself, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So how much of this car, as we look at it, is stock Corvette versus what has been added by Genovation to
sure.
make it what it is?
Well, when the cars come into prefix, they're, stripped down completely almost to every nut and bolt. The front bumper fascia remains the same, but we change the grille and we add that Fang lighting. And in the hood, we add that plexiglass window. It'll be polycarbonate on the next car. And then there's a custom bracketry that attaches to the subframe.
Here, we got the picture up at the front end. Talk about the Fang lighting, as you call it.
Yeah, so when you first plug the car in, if the batteries are empty, you'll see a chasing sequence that fills the fangs with red. And once they're full, you're at 33%, and then it'll switch to blue. And then when you get to 66, it'll turn green. So it's sort of just a neat way to show you the state of charge. And it's fun.
How long for a full charge does it take to recharge it?
So at level two, if it's totally empty, it's between 6 and 7 hours to fully charge it. But we're looking at having a sort of a trackside supercharger.
Okay.
And the idea would be you go out for half an hour and have fun at the track, and then when you're ready for a break, you bring the car in, and you'll get around an 80% charge in about 20 minutes to half an hour, and go back out again, and just have fun like that all day.
Sounds fun.
So is it road legal?
Yeah, street legal. When we broke the records, we had Maryland tags on the car. So. Yeah.
Hey, I'm intrigued. Even though this is a C7, you've gone with round tail lamps. And for some Corvette owners, that is the way to do it. So why'd you choose to do that?
Well, I just think it's so iconic. And it's an American icon to begin with. And we just sort of had this vision in our head that it would look really amazing with this type of taillight. And we found a company in Ashburn, Virginia called Transforged. And they had done similar taillights for a Lotus. And so we got in touch with them and said, we want to do something a little bit different from what you already have, a little bit bigger. Mm-hmm. And they came through in a big way. They're gorgeous.
That's a really good look, I must say. It's very iconic.
No kidding. Who did your styling?
It was a fellow from San Francisco named Marcos Noland. He works for Staffel Systems, who's our technology partner. And, young guy, but he's just, we sort of gave him some direction and he just took it and ran with it. And we were blown away by what he came up with. It's amazing.
Oh, interesting what you just said. Technology partner. Go into a little bit of you didn't come up with this engineering then.
It was collaborative. But Staffel Systems, Eric Staffel is the founder and CEO. And he writes the software for the controller. They're his battery management control boards. So yeah, he is a MIT grad. So very bright guy. Could not have done this without him. So yeah, integral part of the team. Yeah.
So the electric part of this has something to do with environmental concerns that you have, or you just
thought it's a
badass propulsion system?
It was a bit of both. You know, we got into electric vehicles because we love cars, but we don't love pollution. And, you know, when you look down the road, you know, for the sake of our children and grandchildren, we really need to start moving down a different path. And I think that electric vehicles, when you combine it with renewable energy, it just makes so much sense. And, you know, in the future, when we have millions of electric vehicles and garages, it'll supplement the grid through vehicle-to-grid technology. It'll make the grid more stable, more efficient, and the break-even is much faster on both the batteries and the solar cells. So it's a perfect marriage of technologies, and so that's really what, you know, we saw.
Can you tell us about your charger itself? Is it something you guys developed? Do you use somebody else's charger? How does that work?
Yeah, the onboard charger, we've used a few different ones in different prototypes. This one comes from a company in Italy called EDN.
Okay.
And, yeah, it's a very nice charger, absolutely. Cool. It's a 10 kilowatt, so you can get a pretty decent charge. But we are working with the University of Maryland on some charger technology to hopefully make things a little bit smaller, a little lighter, looking at using silicon carbide chipsets and things like that. So, yeah.
I want you to go back and talk a little bit more of the fabrication and design of the interior, because you were telling me before the show, you cut the dash in half or something like that. You pick it up from there.
Okay. So, yeah, the Corvette came with a fairly small touchscreen, and we wanted to put a larger, more Tesla-like touchscreen in. And the one that's in there is very cutting edge. It's a really nice piece. It's 4G, LTE, Wi-Fi, Bluetooth, all the good stuff.
To make it fit,
we had to take the dash out, and there was a beautiful bezel. We had to cut it in half and then 3D print a new bezel for the surround for the touchscreen, fiberglassed it back together, sanded it down, repainted it, piano black, and you would never know. I mean, it looks...
Here we got a picture of the screen in there. And the picture doesn't do it justice. It looks far more integrated when you see it with your own eyes than what this picture shows.
Absolutely, yeah. And the software that is behind that touchscreen is really fantastic. And we're going to have apps that you can do some really fun things with, too. I don't want to give too much away, but our apps, it's really looking good. It's going to be fun for people, especially when you take the car to the track. The things we're going to be able to do, it's neat.
So I'm a little puzzled by a manual transmission with an electric motor. Is there a clutch?
There is. You can't stall it. It's the easiest stick shift in the world to drive. You can put it in third gear and just drive around town all day if you want. And when we broke the records, we didn't use first gear. It was just over too quickly with all that torque. So we launched in second gear, and we didn't use sixth gear because that was an overdrive and really wouldn't have helped us. But, yeah, you drive it just like you would a gas-powered car, and you get a feel for it really quickly. You know, through the software, we can really dial it in so it feels just like the V8 did. It's just a different sound. There's a shift light, so it tells you the ideal shift point. But yeah, it's very intuitive, smooth.
But you literally do have to downshift all the way down to start and stop the vehicle? Or could you just have it in third and say to hell with it?
You could leave it in second and third and just drive around town. But if you're on the track, obviously, you want to use that that torque multiplication. And that's the neat thing. People don't realize that, you know, with a Tesla, a single-speed transmission, it's very, very quick off the line, but it tops out at 155, and at that speed, the motors are spinning at, I think, 16,000 RPMs. And if you went any faster, you'd over-rev the motors and damage them. Mm-hmm. So that's why the multi-speed transmission made sense. We really don't need six or seven or eight gears in the automatic. You know, three or four would probably be fine, but four was ideal, really.
So do you heel and toe? Do you blip the accelerator to blip the electric engine to match gears?
You definitely could. It'll do rev matching. We can do that, too.
So you kept the paddles from the factory on there that you can...
Yeah.
Wow, that's pretty...
Yeah, on the current prototype that we're
building. Would not expect that with an EV. That's pretty wild.
It's going to be so much fun to get on a track with some nice hairpins and have some fun. So
how about the driving modes? Are there... You mentioned you could kind of tailor the experience to your taste. Like, can you walk us through the driving modes of the car?
Yeah, so there'll be a valet mode,
okay.
And then, street mode, sport mode, track mode, and then extreme mode, which will be full power.
Extreme mode. That sounds fun.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah.
Hey, we got a number of questions here. Mike from San Francisco says, why'd you decide to electrify a Corvette and not build something original?
Well, using an existing platform, we have limited working capital, and so that really
saved a ton of time and money.
And we really felt like, the Corvette's got that great aluminum frame. It's world class and an American icon. Most of the technology we're using is American technology. And so we really felt like it just seemed to make sense. Yeah.
Let's see. Andreas S. says, will there be more models, not including Corvettes?
Down the road, hopefully, if things go well, we would like to do it.
Sell the first 75.
Sell the first 75, and then we may do a handful of race versions. We're talking with some of our suppliers about doing maybe a race car, which would be super lightweight, all carbon fiber. So I don't want to say where we're going to take it, but that's going to be a lot of fun.
Very interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
Where are the batteries at?
So there are five modules. There's one under the hood, and that straddles the motors, and then there are two inverters on top of that. The next car will have a slightly different configuration, but then the next module is in the exhaust tunnel and then the two gas tank cavities. So trying to give it a low center of gravity and a 50-50 weight distribution.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a module in the trunk, but there's still room for golf clubs or the removable
clubs.
Yeah.
Because every time you go to the track, you need those clubs.
You do.
You might want to play nine afterwards.
No, you just want to be able to go to your golf club in an electric Corvette.
There you go.
Wright Knight wants to know, what's the weight of the car?
It's around 4,200 pounds. So, it's not.
That's not bad at all.
No, it's 1,000 pounds heavier.
I thought you were going to say like 6,000 pounds or something.
It's 1,000 pounds less than a Model S. So, and a lot of the weight is down low. So, mm-hmm. there's very little body roll.
Mm-hmm.
We had it at the M1 track in Pontiac, Michigan, and it felt really planted. I mean, we had a professional driver, he wasn't even pushing the car. In fact, we had it in valet mode, but I was holding on for dear life. It felt great.
What does it sound like?
It sounds like a jet. And in fact, some of our videos from the runway, you can hear it. The first time we ran it fast, we didn't know what it would sound like, and I thought a jet was coming into land. So I'm getting the walkie-talkie ready to tell the driver to abort. And they're like, no, it's the car.
So you didn't engineer this sound deliberately.
No.
It just ended up being that way.
Absolutely.
I have heard it on one of the videos, and it does sound awesome.
It whooshes by.
It sounds really cool.
Yeah, it's got a nice techie sound.
Monday Fool wants to know, why the $750,000 price tag?
So it's based on a number of factors. One is that the components are very cutting edge. They're not cheap. Volume would do a lot to drive those costs down, but that's just where it is right now. It's got two world records. We're only building 75, and the build quality, as you've mentioned, is absolutely phenomenal. So those are the reasons why we justify the price.
Yep.
It's an exclusive car that you get to help design. So.
Okay, Nigel Ware wrote in to say, hi from Northern Ireland. Nice to see an American dinosaur enter the future. Does the Corvette have proper suspension? What's the battery size? Well, you talked about that and the charging time and rate. So, yeah, what kind of suspension? Stock?
So the Corvette comes with a great suspension. I mean, it's set some great lap times at different racetracks around the world. But we decided to go with an adjustable coilover suspension. And it's programmable, so you can dial it in for different stiffnesses for different tracks. And actually, it can sense how fast the car is going. It can actually stiffen the front when you're hitting the brakes hard at high speed to prevent the nose from diving, and keeps the car fairly flat and planted around the corner. So it's a really nice setup. Yeah.
Because writes in to say, I'm a V8 guy who sees the electric Vette as a natural evolution. Yeah, it's a kick in the gut to admit the V8 era is ending.
Well, it'll still be around for a while.
Oh, decades.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yes.
There's no question. And our thought is, you can have both. If you love your V8, then, you know, by all means. But you can also have this, and this is a lot of fun, too.
Yeah.
So they're not mutually exclusive.
No, that's right.
Andrew, let's say that Greg wants to buy one of these. His wife might not want him to, but we'll just say for the sake of argument that he wants to buy one of these. I mean, how would someone go about ordering one?
So we have an order build agreement that you would have to sign. Give us a deposit of $250,000, and then you deliver your car. So the customer would buy the car and deliver it to Prefix, and we would begin the build process. And the goal is to build 4 a month and until we build all 75.
How much time does it take per car to sort of design and engineer it?
Oh, my gosh. It's a lot. I mean, especially the very first one we built, this car and the C6 before. I mean, it's thousands of man hours go into it.
It sounds like you're, like, on the cusp of, like, you could do an all-wheel drive version if you want. Would you ever consider something like that?
Maybe, yeah.
An all-wheel drive Corvette, that sounds pretty awesome, right?
It'd definitely be possible, yeah.
Okay. And being electric, it would be far easier to do it than a conventional way.
Oh, I think so. Yeah, there's no question. Yeah. It would be challenging, but possible, yeah.
Caraga.
That would be a heck of a car. Yeah.
Caraga One wrote in to say, I got a horse carriage. I wonder if this company could electrify it.
Well, we could electrify just about anything. Yes. It's just a matter of cost. The first one is the most expensive by far.
Where will you make them?
In Michigan.
At Prefix?
At Prefix. Uh-huh. Yeah. They're our build partners, and they're fantastic contract manufacturers. So.
Right. Yeah. No, they're stellar.
Yeah.
So when I think of Maryland, I don't think of the auto industry, nor do I think of
sports cars.
Yeah, advanced electronics.
Right?
Yeah, I mean, it's just so.
Why? A bit of an anomaly.
Yeah, we think of the Chesapeake Bay and crab cakes.
Yeah, I do too. Nothing wrong with that. But there's also a lot of great technology. We've got fantastic research facilities. So I mean, there are a lot of great minds in Maryland, and. So, I mean, it's just, you know, it's one of those things.
Yeah.
We're doing something a little bit differently, but I think the results speak for themselves.
Mm-hmm. So. No, they really do. In fact, you talked about something that I really like, adjustable wing
mm-hmm.
and being able to set up the car for different tracks.
That's right.
That's pretty unique.
Yeah, with being able to adjust the regen, the suspension, the wing.
And when I say adjustable wing, I mean on the fly,
on
right?
The fly.
That's what you're talking about, not just, change it, wrench it down, and
exactly.
That's it for the lap.
It'll change pitch instantly. It reacts so quickly. In fact, if you're going at a high rate of speed and you nail the brakes, it'll act as an air brake. So it was tested at the MIT wind tunnel and designed by a couple of MIT graduates. And so our own aerodynamicist did a CFD analysis on it, and he said, yeah, it's got one of the best downforce to drag ratios he's ever seen. So,
man, I got to believe, just besides ideating the car, just going out and finding all these people you did, that must have been a blast, too.
Oh, yeah. It's been phenomenal. From the carbon fiber wheels all the way up to, the whole drivetrain, it's been really interesting finding the different pieces and the different people to make it happen.
Okay, so you're working on your third prototype now.
That's right.
When might somebody be able to buy one? Do you think? What are you targeting?
So we're going to be offering prospects test drives in Monterey for the first time. And that'll be
this year,
late August.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'll continue that into the fall. So, we're ready to take deposits now.
Yeah. Awesome.
Yeah.
So John asked you whether the Chevy guys, how they felt about this. Have you heard from other OEMs saying to you, hey, we'd like to see your technology and what you've done with this car?
We've heard from a couple. Yeah, internationally, no domestics, but it just for one reason or another, it hasn't really materialized,
mm-hmm.
Which is fine. I mean, we want to stay lean and mean, we're nimble, and so in a way, it's been advantageous for us to sort of do our own thing.
Mm-hmm.
What was like your aha moment? Like, I got to believe, a lot of people think, hey, an electric Corvette, that's a great idea, and then you leave it there. Like, at what point did it just kind of click in your head, I can do this?
It was really when we found the right team members.
Okay.
Finding Staffel Systems was really a key moment for us. But it really started with the inverters. Once we learned about Reinhart Motion Systems and got to know those guys, they're a fantastic team. They actually introduced us to Eric Staffel. The AM Racing makes our motors. They're also from Oregon, just like Reinhart.
Sure.
Another great, small, nimble team that's getting stuff done. And so it was really building that core team initially, and then all the other, you know, suppliers that have come on and partners that have come on. It's been amazing.
You kind of hinted at racing earlier. Yeah. You know, where does that stand? Is that still like on the drawing board? Are you guys moving a little sooner? To me, it seems like this is a very natural fit.
It's absolutely.
The pace car for Formula E or something.
Absolutely. There's no question. I think it is a natural fit. And so hopefully, if things go well, we'll probably kick that off this fall.
Cool.
And have something ready by springtime for sure. And that'll be a lot of fun.
Look, we're going to have to wrap this up, but Andrew Saul, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you,
especially
John.
For bringing the Genovation electric Corvette along with you, too.
Thank
really,
you so much.
Really impressive.
Well, great to be here, and thank you for having me on and for checking out the GXE.
Good deal.
Thanks.
We're going to take a quick commercial break. We'll be back to talk more about what the heck is going on in this automotive industry.
Lear Kinexis offers a parental controls application with geofencing that sends notifications regarding driving behavior and location, including curfew alerts, acceleration alerts, and speed alerts. All delivered to a smartphone application that includes vehicle location, driver notifications, and a report card of driving history, including notifications when predefined geographic boundaries are crossed. For more information, visit Lear.com.
All right, we're back, and thanks to Bridgestone and Lear for making this show possible. But this is the part of the show where it's time for Dr. Data.
Okay, so for this one, I was actually surprised at the number. And Greg's a veteran of this, and so he knows the. So let's have the first number so these guys can begin to discern what the answer is. So this is 846, excuse me, out of 1,000. Now this has to do with the auto industry, and I'm quite surprised. Okay, so this is a percentage of a bigger number, a much bigger number.
That's a tough one.
I'd say it is. I'm just going to throw a guess out there. I know it's wrong, but I got a guess. So 846 trucks, SUVs, and CUVs and SUVs are sold for every 1,000 vehicles.
No. Yeah. I'll give you another clue. So it has to do with people.
People. Okay. I would say this is the number of people who would not be interested in an autonomous car.
That's a good guess. Do you want to take another shot at it?
846 out of 1,000 cannot drive a manual transmission.
That would probably be an exaggeration. You'd be too many people would have that capability. All right. So the answer is U.S. drivers per 1,000 of driving age population. So people who are above 16 years of age. It's a phenomenal number of people who actually have driver's licenses.
85%?
Yeah. Who'd have thunk it? So do we have there's a third one with a big number. So there we have the number of licensed drivers in the United States versus the number of people who are 16 and older.
250 million people, 16 and older. 212 million of them have a driver's license.
Yeah. Because everything we seem to hear is that young people have no interest in cars, right?
Well, it seems like maybe they do.
Yeah, that's the thing that I find to be so surprising.
They like to drive.
Yeah.
You know what I think about those studies? They kind of crack me up because it's like, well, millennials or Generation X, Y, Z, whatever's after Z, they don't like cars. But it seems like it leaves out the fact that, like, they're, like, barely turning 16, and then they don't account for the fact that people get their license maybe a little bit later now, you know? And it's, like, kind of this knee-jerk reaction to pigeonhole sort of younger people into not wanting to drive. Maybe they just get their license at 18 or 20.
Right.
Yeah, in fact, I just saw somebody put out a release today. I wish I could remember who it was that said millennials are the ones who have been driving all the growth in new car sales in the U.S. this year. That is where the growth is coming from.
Well, I think the interesting thing part of that is that millennials are now actually getting to be like 30, 35. Like, millennials aren't these like young skateboarder whatever types that maybe stereotypically you might think they are. And they have kids. They have dogs. They need to buy things. You know, you can't take the subway from your loft and, you know, wherever. You got to get something.
And come back with washing machine.
Right. You need transportation. So.
Right.
It mm-hmm. seems natural.
Yeah. So the car industry isn't dead quite yet.
That's good. Right. That's really good for all of us, right?
Yeah, it is. So, but one thing that's going on this today, which could have a negative impact on the auto industry, is this: the Secretary of Commerce is looking at applying the 25% tariff on imported cars and car parts, and there's been like complete by the auto industry pushback,
100% opposition. The Secretary of Commerce that you're talking about is Wilbur Ross, mm-hmm. who is a billionaire, of course, but owns a bunch of companies that are heavily involved in the automotive industry.
Yeah, there is. I read a story that Forbes, the capitalist tool, I must point out, because you know this is not some like you know Mother Jones
right.
or New Republic that basically like looked at Ross's holdings and IAC. That we had Steve Miller on the show from IAC, and it doesn't look good. I mean, it's all legal, but it doesn't look good. But, you know, I mean, I was really surprised. So, like, the Automotive Alliance, which consists of the 12 major automakers in the world, okay, so this Ford and General Motors and Fiat Chrysler and Toyota and so on and so forth. And when I was looking at the list, it really surprised me that when you get right down to it, there are just two American manufacturers now.
True, GM and Ford.
Right. I mean, we all think there are three, right? I mean, we automatically think, you know, FCA is an American company, but it isn't.
I kind of made my peace that it's like an Italian company, to be honest.
It's not even.
It's a
Dutch company.
Right, yeah,
right.
Yeah.
A company from the Netherlands with headquarters in London. But that's all the legal structure. I mean, let's get real. For the vast amount of design, engineering, and manufacturing, it's all Chrysler, and all the profits, too, by the way, just about, I should add, are being generated right here.
So what I thought was interesting is that, so, you know, the National Auto Dealers Association came out against this, and they quoted some numbers from Edmunds, which I think are really quite shocking, I think, when you look at what the implications could be. So the head of the NADA, Peter Welch, said the monthly car payment, average monthly car payment for a new vehicle stands at how much? Guess.
$280.
No, it's way higher. It's incredibly high. I'll bet you it's like $420.
$533 per month.
That's some really
at an average
financing.
Average term length of 69 months.
Yowza.
And so they're saying that a tariff that would be $4,400 on top of that would increase new car payments to $611 per month.
Glad I bought a car in December.
You know.
Yeah, I mean, it's just.
I know I've seen those numbers. I want to see the math behind them. I don't think the vast majority of people are paying anywhere near that.
It seems like that would be a case where you don't put any money down at all, you know, or you get
right.
the worst possible rate.
Or maybe it's including mm-hmm. all the insurance and yeah. maintenance and fuel and all that. Then I might. But you're saying
I'm just quoting the guy. My number. But and another thing I also read that apparently the insurance industry has pointed out that should those tariffs take effect, that insurance rates will go up because the price of automobiles will be higher.
That makes sense, based on their kind of algorithmic formula that we don't fully understand, that would just, why not raise the rates?
Right. And then maintenance expenses will go up because many of the parts
right.
are
right.
imported. And, I mean,
So do you here's my question to you, Gary. Do you think this is going to go through?
You know, I sure as hell hope not, for a number of reasons. And the thing that really strikes me, I mean, this is so absurd. So, okay, they're using the Section 232 of the Trade Expansion Act of 1962, okay? So basically, and this is a quote from the Commerce Department. This is not from some guy at NADA or the Auto Alliance or any place else. This is from the website of the Commerce Department. If the Secretary finds that automobiles and or automotive parts are being imported to the United States in such quantities or under such circumstances as to threaten to impair the national security, the Secretary shall recommend actions and steps that should be taken to adjust automobiles and or automotive parts imports so they'll not threaten to impair the national security. So can somebody explain to me how cars will affect the national security?
Yeah, I can tell you exactly how. Because I went to the National Defense University in Washington, D.C. This is some years ago. That's where you learn how to take your country to war. They don't teach battlefield tactics and strategy. They teach how you take your whole country to war. And so much of that is based on your industrial capacity. And these guys absolutely believe that the automotive industry is 100% critical to the national security of the country.
Okay, but here's the point. Okay, if you look at Toyota, you look at Honda, you look at BMW, you look at Mercedes, you look at Hyundai, you look at Kia, who am I leaving out? You look at Nissan. They all have factories here. They all
Tesla?
Have
right.
Giant factories here.
Right.
So
it's not so much them as it is the suppliers. And that's because very few of the automakers, in fact, I can only think of General Motors right now. There actually is a division called General Motors Defense.
Right.
GM has not said much about this. They've sort of just rekindled it on the QT. But when you look at suppliers, there are a lot of defense suppliers that do a little bit of automotive business. And there's quite a number of automotive suppliers that do a bit of defense business. And so if either one of them loses their defense business and or their automotive business, they go belly up in many cases. It's not a big part of their business, typically only 10 to 15%, but they cannot afford to lose it.
Well, I just look at it from the point of view. In 1962, the world was a much different place.
Very different. And
there were perhaps, you know, so there was the GM parts division, and there was the Ford parts division, and Chrysler. You know, I mean, it's all different now.
Well, look, back then, GM, Ford, and Chrysler were heavily involved in military procurement.
Right.
In fact, the Sterling Heights plant made rockets, missiles.
Well, look at the Willow Run plant, Arsenal of Democracy. Yeah, Not much of it is still standing.
But that was a purpose-built plant, though, and that was the thing that Edsel Ford...
Well, that was in the middle of a war, okay?
Right. So,
you know, that was...
And this time, we're not going to have a middle of a war because, you know, when those nukes come flying over, we have...
There won't be time to build a factory.
You've got 13 seconds. I don't think we're going to be retrofitting, you know, the Rouge plant for... munitions.
I just think it's so wild that they're using like a 56-year-old law and like kind of shoehorning it to apply to this modern day scenario that it's, you know, it's definitely reading the contract, the letter of the law, and applying it in a way that it probably was never meant to be applied.
What do you think is going to happen, Greg? Do you think they're going to go through with these
tariffs? I hope and don't think it's going to go through. I think something is going to happen that's going to make it just go off the rails.
See, that's what I thought. And I first thought that, okay, they're just trying to get these other countries to the bargaining table and we'll hammer. Now I think they're going to do it.
You think we're at the goal line?
I think they're going to do it. I think it's going to be 25%.
It's going to be crazy.
Well, look,
well,
on trucks, right?
It's true.
I mean, you know, and look at what China's doing. You know, they're 25% import tariff. Plus, if you want to make anything there, you got to find a partner and give them half your profits and all your technology. Well, I think this is how the game's getting played.
All right.
Now.
Okay. So just according to the Center for Automotive Research, and we'll be going to the management briefing seminar in two weeks. Okay. They did a study, consumer impact, potential U.S. Section 232 tariffs and quotas on the imported automobiles and automotive parts. And they found that the 25% tariff will result in a 2 million unit reduction in the total number of new vehicles sold in the United States. A total U.S. employment loss of nearly 714,000 jobs and GDP losses of $59 billion. So I have a feeling when you have a job loss of 714,000, it ain't going to go over so well.
Except that, you know, if you go back to the early 80s in the Reagan administration, we established the Voluntary Restraint Agreement, where we told the Japanese, you can only sell this many cars and that's it. You can only bring in 7-8 million or something like, let's just call it 1.8 million cars. That's it. And so the Japanese knew the only way that we can grow is to come build plants in America. And many of the same arguments were being made back then. This is bad for the consumer. It's going to drive up costs of everything. You know, it's not going to let people have as much choice in what they want. And here we are, and everything's hunky-dory. And
what was the first word in that term?
Well, voluntary. Yeah, but it wasn't voluntary. It was not voluntary at all.
All right, moving right along. All right, so I thought this was sort of surprising. So this week, like many car
companies. Oh, wait, I have to interrupt before we get into this, because Cameron Sowers just wrote in, and you talked about the average monthly payment. Mm-hmm. Cameron says, average is misleading. What's the median? That's a good point.
That's a good point, yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, because if you have a bunch of people buying super expensive cars, it can drag the average up.
A lot of different options.
You buy a few of these electric Corvettes.
That might just skew the whole thing.
Yeah.
So thanks for that, Cameron.
Good Although I would sort of imagine that if you look at the number of high-end pickup trucks that are being sold, I mean, that seems to be what everyone's buying, right?
Everybody needs a decked-out Silverado, right?
That's right, you know.
Got to have one.
High Country.
Maybe two.
Platinum edition of the Ford F-150.
Yeah. King Lariat, Ranch, Super, Monster.
You know, yeah. You know. So maybe that number...
That's dragging the number up, maybe, right?
Yeah, because I don't think there's a whole lot of people that are buying, you know, Kia Fortes and Ford Fiestas and things like that.
Hyundai Accents.
And I'm going to stop you one more time before you get into the next one. Just to say, Lost in the Kerf wrote in to say, it's Brown Shoe Day on Autoline After Hours.
Yeah, yes, it is. 2 out of 3 wingtips.
Yeah. Thanks for noticing.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, go ahead, Gary.
All right, so I sort of thought this was surprising. So every automaker now is involved in some way, it seems, with ride hailing, car sharing, mm-hmm. and that sort of thing. And so BMW has its version of this, which is called Reach Now. And it's headquartered in Seattle. And they came out this week where basically they are now, they claim to be the first company in the world to operate both car sharing and ride hailing from the same app. A milestone for mobility services industry, and one we're excited to show our members. This is the chief customer officer is saying this. So basically, I mean, when you drill into what this guy's is saying is, and oddly enough, he quotes the Center for Automotive Research. So our friends in Ann Arbor are really getting some run here.
A lot of ink here,
and they're saying that by 2021, one car sharing vehicle will replace 7.7 private vehicles in North America. So here's BMW basically mm-hmm. saying, you know what? They're going to replace these vehicles, and so we want them to give us income by driving around in BMW cars.
Smart move.
But, I mean, is it a smart move?
I don't think it's going to happen, though. I don't totally buy that number. It seems a little ambitious.
The 7.7?
Yeah, that seems aggressive.
See, I was going to say, tell you guys, I've talked to people at Zipcar and Uber and Maven. They say the number is 15 to 1, and that in certain high-density areas, like the Bay Area, San Francisco, I should say, it can be as high as 22 to 1.
That's the average. What's the median?
Yeah.
Well played.
1.2.
Yeah. Right. But, I mean, so is it clever of them to do this?
I think it's a neat sort of trick for the app itself. I don't know if the consumer really benefits that much from it, unless you're such a dyed-in-the-wool, like, you know, BMW loyalist.
Right.
I mean, I don't know. I imagine that service would be a bit more expensive than just taking an Uber and riding around in whatever.
Whatever shows up.
Yeah, Dune Corolla shows up. I'd rather pay for that. Mm-hmm. I don't need a 5 Series.
See, and I was thinking about this, you know, so, you know, they're conveniently located in Seattle, but you just think about, like, Seattle now is one of the, you know, wealth centers.
Right. It's where Peugeot wants to go and launch their mobility thing.
Really?
That's free to ride, I think, is theirs.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
So they're going to do it there as well?
Yeah. So I think they are there, in fact.
Really?
Believe it or not, yeah.
Uh-huh.
They're very quiet about their plans. They have been tiptoeing around, but that's a non sequitur, I guess.
But so is this something that would work? Okay, so we'd say Seattle, maybe Portland, San Francisco, L.A., New York, Chicago. What about, I don't know, Detroit?
Kansas City.
For ride sharing?
For ride sharing. This combination.
Maven told me that this is at a snapshot in time, right, because they're building up, that their fastest growing market was the Midwest.
Really?
Chicago, Detroit.
Detroit, even.
Interesting.
And, yeah, I was shocked to hear that.
Yeah.
But, you know, maybe that's starting from nothing and you go up, you know, you get a few customers. Woo, look at the percentage increase. So I don't know if it's something like that, but they were actually very bullish on the Midwest.
Mm-hmm. I actually feel like if there is that sort of core, like, you know, robust urban area, I don't think it necessarily matters about geography. Like, I could see that concept working Detroit, Indy, Pittsburgh, just as well as, you know, San Francisco. Mm-hmm. Why not? It's the same layout. Right. You know, mm-hmm. people want to have that same urban, you know, lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
So,
could be an issue of disposable income.
Could be. Yeah. Millennials.
There you go.
Income.
See? They... All right. So, now, last week we almost did the show without the word being mentioned, and this week we can't do the show without the word being mentioned, and that word, of course, is Tesla. So, John, this week you broke some more news with regard to what was going on in the Monroe & Associates teardown of the Model 3. So for those who are unaware of this, and it's surprising that anybody on earth would be unaware of this, but for those few that are, tell us what you found.
Well, what Sandy found is, you know, let me back up one step and say, first video that we did with Sandy, he hated the fit and finish of the car. He thought that the body in white design was 200 pounds too heavy.
Of the Model 3.
Of the Model 3, exactly right. He found some real goofy design flaws. Then when we drove the car, he was a bit more impressed about the car. Hey, he liked the road-hugging capabilities because, you know, the low center of gravity due to the batteries and all that. And then he started getting into the electronics and all and was pretty impressed by that. And then when he did his final analysis, his conclusion is that the typical Model 3, which is, let's face it, they're $50,000 cars and above. But he was saying that they make about a 36% profit, gross profit on that vehicle. Gross profit means all the parts and components and the materials and the labor and the amortization of the tools and all that. Subtracted from the MSRP, he's saying that they make over 30%.
Okay, so what does BMW make on a 5 Series or a 3 Series or?
I wouldn't think that much. That seems to be almost to indicate that the car is overpriced.
Well, you know, Sandy's said no other luxury cars make that kind of margin, but no other electric car comes anywhere close to having that capability. Okay. That if you look at the cost of making the car, it's over the MSRP. And so he's saying that, you know, if his conclusion is as long as Tesla can hit their 5,000 a week of the Model 3 making them, they're going to be able to generate a lot of cash. I'm not sure I go along completely with it. I totally respect Sandy's findings and his analysis, but you got to look at the total company. And from a financial standpoint, the total company is a basket case. And I'm not sure that just having a Model 3 that's got the capability of good gross margins that they're going to pull it through.
I mean, if they could even sort of get it like 65% of the way there, I think just the enthusiasm people have for the company, you know, even if he gets tight on cash, just that like two-thirds measure might be enough to drum up another round of investors, you know, give him, you know, more like mad money to get him through his crisis.
Yeah.
So, does it surprise you what Sandy found?
Well, yes, it did. But then when he started explaining how Tesla took cost out, the light bulb started to go on, even in my dim brain. But what Sandy found is that Tesla has consolidated all the electronics in the car into a little stack of motherboards that sit under the rear seat. So one of his cost examples was comparing the interior rear view mirror of the i3, the Model 3, and the Chevy Bolt. And there's a wide disparity in price there, cost. And so when you think about every component that's on a car right now, they all come with chips and integrated circuits that are put in by the suppliers. So not only does Tesla put them all in one spot, so they're not embedded in the components, they have chips or ICs doing double duty. Mm. So I'll give an example. I don't know if it's the right example. You know, it might control the mirror for one thing. Yeah. It might, you know, control the heated seats for another, you know. But by doing double duty and taking the cost out of the components, they need far fewer chips and ICs, and the cost of the components really drops. So that in a nutshell, is, I'm sure Sandy would go into more detail, and we'll have him here sometime next month. But that's how they got the cost out.
Okay. Just so that's pretty interesting finding that he...
Pretty deep.
Yeah.
It seems like they kind of know how to make a car, but maybe they don't. Like, that was when Monroe did a, you know, they did a breakfast a few months ago around here, and it, my takeaway from that, too, was, like, they sort of know what they're doing. That seemed to really be what Sandy said, and, right. You know, I don't know, maybe you have a different take, but it's like they're,
no, he's,
they kind of know what they're doing.
He said when it comes to all the mechanical bits, there's nothing impressive about the car.
Okay.
In fact, like he said, the body in white should be 200 pounds lighter.
Yeah, okay.
But when it comes to the electronics, he says they're a decade ahead of every other automaker. Okay. And that the electronics are laid out, the density of electronics is what you would expect to find in a cell phone, not in a car. And built to mil spec, military spec, not to automotive spec.
Wow.
So he's blown away by the electronics of the car.
Mm-hmm. All right, so final subject here. I find this to be astonishing. So this week, in a plant in England, the 1 millionth Nissan Juke was produced. They produce a Juke every 105 seconds, so I think that they could probably do 5,000 a week without a problem. But and in Europe, the Juke is a huge sales success. Last year, they sold over 95,000 Jukes. In the United States, they sold 10,157 Jukes. Okay, and to put that in the context, Nissan to Nissan, that in 2017, Nissan sold 11,230 Leafs. Okay, so we all have this sort of notion that design is global, that taste is global, that everybody basically would be interested in a car, whether you're in Paris or in Pittsburgh, whether you're in, I don't know, Beijing or Boston. Okay, what's up with the Juke? I mean, explain this to me.
It seems like just consumers here, it's just a little too far afield for them. They look at that and they're like, whoa, okay, let's see what that Rogue thing is over there, you know, and they just keep walking. I mean, the first time I drove one, I thought, oh, okay, this is kind of cool. Interior is like, meh, you know, and then you look at the outside and you're like, okay, I think I'll, you know, it's like the Ted Nugent of cars, you know, like it's just a little like it's not for everybody. And if you're really into it, you're going to love it. If not, I don't know.
But the point you raise is a really good one, Gary, is styling now common throughout the world. And I think you got a good example here of it's not. There are different tastes in different countries.
So, you know, the thing that I've long wondered about is that I thought that, you know, with all of the flexibility that we're purportedly have with regard to manufacturing, that we should have this tremendous flexibility, that, you know, that there could be a car that Greg likes that would be detailed to your wishes, and John, there'd be a modified version for you, and then I'd get something that would be, you know, and it would be cost effective and efficient and so on. But that hasn't happened, right? I mean, we're all still looking at economies of scale, and we're just thinking, okay, you know, when Tesla can make $5,000 or 5,000 cars a week, that'll be the thing that'll sustain the company. And so it's all mass. It isn't anything but that. And, you know, where does Quirk come into this whole thing?
I think it's sort of, the Juke is like an extreme case. You know, if it were maybe a little bit more like over here instead of like way over there, you know, maybe more people could get on board with it, but it's, you know, I think it was the wrong time, you know.
It depends, though, because what's the Hyundai one? Or Kia crossover. That's
Niro?
No. Kia Soul.
Kia Soul.
Thank you, Sean, who said that from off camera. Kia Soul's kind of edgy in the same way. And it's quite successful. Yeah. The Nissan Cube was an abysmal disaster.
All right, but see, I would say that the Soul the ground was broken.
Look at that. The picture of the Soul.
Okay,
right,
but the ground was broken for the Soul by the Scion XB. Remember?
Yes and no.
I mean, it looks like it.
They're kind of boxes on wheels sort of thing.
See, the original XB was not designed. It's literally a little Japanese delivery van kind of thing that they made a passenger version
out of.
Got a
hood and there was a box on the back.
It was a box. And then when they went, oh my gosh, we've got a great hit on our hands, let's style it now, they destroyed it. They jumped the shark.
And you know where it was styled? At Kelty in California.
I know that.
The first
that.
One, where was it styled? In Japan.
In Japan. But right. It wasn't styled. It was engineered.
And the Kia Soul was designed in California. Go figure.
Yeah. But I like the Soul. I mean, I know it doesn't make sense, but I think the Soul looks pretty good.
I'm with you.
It's
like
a good-looking vehicle.
Right.
A car, whatever.
Well, they've toned it down a little bit. I'm thinking of the original one.
I like that one, too.
The same
speakers
here.
Lit up. It was
wheels.
Crazy. Yeah.
Yeah.
It had shag carpet, I think,
Cube.
That was the cube head.
Yeah, that little
carpet.
Round thing or oval that was
strictly
on your...
Strictly functional, of course.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the word to keep the your hula girl on there.
That's right.
On there.
Hey, look, we're going to have to wrap this show up, and the reason I'm saying so is the only way I'm going to get a ride in this electric Corvette is if we wrap the show up now, because Carmen told me she's got to get out of here, but we have enough time to maybe get a road test in. So we're going to have to wrap it up.
All right. We're done.
Great.
That
Greg
was fun.
Miglior, great having you on the show.
Thanks for having me. A lot of fun.
Gary, good to see you again, as always, and we'll do it again next week.
All right.
All right. Thanks, everybody, for having tuned in.
AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion, and by Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems.
Visit our website, AutoLine.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday afternoons. Get your daily fix with AutoLine Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with AutoLine This Week. There's all that and much more at AutoLine.tv.